Blog Talk Radio.
Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, and I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon or morning or evening or wherever it may be in your little corner of the world. I'm glad you're here because I have two excellent guests lined up on the program today, and I'm going to get to my first guest, David R. Young, here in just a moment because I do see that he's on the line. But before we do that, I wanted to let you guys know that yesterday I filled in for our Military Monday host, John D. Gresham, who was on location in New Mexico. Pretty exciting stuff. He was acting as a consultant, a military consultant, for an extreme travel show that's going to be coming out with the Travel Channel. I believe the series is going to air, I think he told me, the end of August or sometime around the end of the summer this year. So John was traveling, and he was unable to host the show yesterday. So instead, I filled in for him. And he came on in the beginning to tell us a little bit about what he was up to, kind of in between flights, which I really appreciated. But then I went ahead and interviewed Deanna Warwood, the veteran coach, about her work with veterans. And I'll tell you, it was such an inspiring interview because Deanna is not only a proud veteran who hails from a family of military veterans, she's also a cancer survivor and a very savvy, successful businesswoman. And when she returned to civilian life from active duty, she discovered she had a few challenges in making that transition into starting her own business and kind of just getting acclimated with the private workforce. And so what she did was she turned all of those challenges that she overcame into a business in which she assists other veterans to do the same thing, whether they want to start their own business or they want to kind of prepare themselves for job interviews, maybe they're seeking employment. She's got all kinds of great training and support at Veterans Coach. So check out that interview. You can check out all of our archived interviews here on the RightStream Radio Network just by going to blogtalkradio.com/RightStream. The other important message I got from yesterday that I want to be sure to promote today with Deanna is the need for some techie volunteers. Anyone who's really great with the computer, can handle the technical side of things, and would be willing to volunteer a couple of hours of their time right in the privacy of your own home for a virtual event on behalf of Fisher House. And we talked a lot about Fisher House yesterday. And as Deanna described it, it's sort of like a Ronald McDonald House for adults, for family members of veterans who are being treated all over the country when they return. So just check that out. And if you do know somebody who's a techie, or if you yourself are a techie and you'd be willing to help, you can tweet me at Daria Ann, DariaAnne, or tweet Deanna at Veterans Coach on Twitter, or check out my blog post about it at DariaDiGiovanni.com, and listen to the archive from yesterday for RightStream. Any help you can give us would be greatly appreciated. These men and women in uniform who've been defending us and putting their lives on the line at great peril to their own safety and certainly to their physical health deserve all the help we can give them. So please check that out. Okay, well, I am so excited about my first guest today. Before I bring him on, just a little bit of background. I guess it was about a year or so ago, maybe a little over a year, that I published a blog post about the political spectrum, and I had been tipped off to it from another friend on Facebook who had posted it on my page and said, you know, would you mind sharing this, because there's such a great misconception out there about the political spectrum and what it really is, and, you know, I would appreciate it if you would share this with all of your friends, and posted a video, and I thought, well, yeah, this is good. I'm gonna go ahead and put it on my blog. So that's when, sometime after that, I got a comment from David R. Young saying, hey, I wrote a book about this. And that's how I came to find out about his book, The Political Spectrum, Freedom versus Enslavement. And you can find out more about David and his book at his website, thepoliticalspectrum.net. And I put a link to that in the chat room. Just a little, you know, just to put your minds at ease up front, this has absolutely nothing to do with political parties. And I'm actually going to discuss that with David, because I believe that political parties have done a tremendous amount of damage to this country. But we are going to talk about today the true definition of the political spectrum and why it is so vitally important for Americans to understand, number one, what it is, and two, its context, you know, in the annals of history. Because as the old saying goes, if we don't learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it, and certainly we don't want to repeat history, especially the history of the 20th century, which is the bloodiest one on record. So without further ado, I welcome to RightStream Tuesday author David R. Young. Hey, David.
Hello, Daria. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. Thank you for having me back on your show.
I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to have you, David. And I know we've talked on other Blog Talk radio shows, and I certainly want to book you for my Saturday night show with my co-host, Steve, but we'll talk about that offline. Because I think this topic is so incredibly important, and it's been so misunderstood, and I'm just absolutely thrilled that, one, you know, you took the time to write the book, and that you spend so much time, you know, you create these great videos, and you have an excellent website, and there's so many resources that you've created. So first, I guess, David, though, let's have you introduce yourself to the audience, tell us a little bit about you and your background, and then we'll get into the political spectrum.
Well, I actually own a company, architectural design company, in Clearwater, Florida. That's what I do for a living. I was not really involved in politics very much, and I was listening to the, you know, becoming more involved, listening to the rhetoric that goes on with our politicians and what have you. And what got me interested in this was when I would listen to politicians, mainly on the right, speaking of freedom and individual responsibility, and, you know, it all sounded like it aligned with the Constitution of our country. Sounded good to me. And then occasionally I would hear someone refer to these people as fascists, and I was like, that's an interesting concept. Why are they calling someone who's speaking about liberty and individual responsibility as fascist? And that piqued my interest. And the rest is history. I researched. I did a lot of studying of fascism, communism, democracy, socialism. And anyway, I became a buff, you could say, of politics from the viewpoint of that. It's interesting that you were talking, you mentioned talking about various parties, and that's very true. And one of the things I find interesting, if you don't mind me going on with this, is
please, yeah.
One of the things you hear a lot about from everywhere and everyone in the political sphere talks about liberals and conservatives and moderates. And it's often spoke as if these are political systems, and they're not. They're attitudes about issues of the day and what have you. Because if you take a look at, let's just say you take the philosophy of communism and you take a government of, you know, based on communism, within that communist system you have liberals, moderates, and conservatives. If you look at democracy, you'll have the same thing. If you look at socialism or even in fascism, you would still have, even though you have a dictator, you still have within that system people who are more liberal, more conservative, or more moderate regarding that particular political system. You see what
right.
I mean?
Right. Exactly. Thank you for clearing that up, David. I think that causes so much confusion in our current political climate, and that is such a great point.
Yeah, it doesn't define what you really stand for. I mean,
right.
You know, you can say, okay, well, conservatives have these beliefs, and liberals may have beliefs. But what's very especially confusing is that when you have someone who's a liberal, and if you take a look at the original definition of liberal, it had to do with liberty. And so you're thinking a person could be involved with liberalism from the viewpoint of they want more liberty, and that would be true. But if a person that calls themselves a liberal is then, let's just say, takes on some of the campaigning or the goals of, say, communism, which might be like equality. They take on this idea of equality, which is a very false idea of equality. You end up with people who are conservative, which by definition, conservatism is just keeping things as they are. It's keeping things the way they are. Well, when you have people that are calling themselves conservative who are trying to move, not keep things the way they are, but trying to move more toward liberty, now you've got a reverse role of liberalism and conservatism.
Right.
So the original liberals in the United States actually had to do with granting more freedom to more minorities and what have you back, you know, when we were early in our development. We had the black people who were enslaved. You have various different minorities that didn't have as many rights. Women's rights weren't established at that time in terms of voting, what have you. So all those things were in the direction of more liberty for individuals. Now when you have liberalism taking the side of creating more dependency, then there's that reversal of role. They're now going, well, the result of their actions is that people are becoming more dependent on government as opposed to independent from government. And I think that probably clearly states the issue.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. And, you know, David, I want to kind of take a step back and talk about the Constitution for a minute, because I think for all the reasons you just described, there is so much confusion out there, and I could go on and on about pop culture and public education and how people have been sort of deliberately dumbed down in these respects. But when you look at the Constitution, I mean, it was unprecedented in the history of the world. At the time, we had the divine right of kings, you know, in Europe, saying that God personally appointed these people to be kings, and therefore, you know, you subjects have to obey them. Or it was oligarchies, or it was, you know, some form of authoritarianism. And what our founding fathers did, with all of their faults, you know, they were real men. They weren't perfect. But they were able to forge a system of government and fight like hell for it in the American Revolution, where the individual would reign supreme. And one point I really want to make sure that we talk about with regard to slavery, I think they fought about that too, because a lot of them wanted to free the slaves immediately. But the problem was they had their biggest battle at that point was with the greatest army in the world, the biggest empire in the world, Britain. And they had their work cut out for them in that. And so that they had to kind of win that battle first. So could you kind of speak to that?
Well, I guess you could. Yes, I can. Just like you can see communism's progressive agenda, where they, you know, they can't do everything at once. So they take a little bit, and they take a little bit, and they take a little bit. Well, that's the same thing with the agenda of freedom. It's impossible to go from a state that the United States was in at its beginning to an ideal scene overnight just because you wrote a document. So, you know, it was the matter of how much can you get, how much can you move toward the right, toward freedom, and then it continues to move. Eventually it resulted in a war between the states.
Yeah, the Civil War, right.
Exactly. And then, you know, step by step, more and more freedoms were given to people who didn't have them. So you're absolutely right. It's a society. It's a country. It's millions of people, billions of people, and you can't move a culture in a night. They take a while to move. And for instance, it's been 60 years since communism, at least 60 years, it's probably been longer since they've been working on their agenda, and they've made inroads into our country that, all around. But it didn't happen overnight. If they had tried to do it overnight, they would have just been rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead.
No, go ahead, David, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and that's really when we look at our society now, and when you, for instance, take libertarians, as a group, they want immediate results now of every single candidate that they put in place. But it isn't something that's going to happen because a candidate was put in place. It's something that's going to happen as their communication, their message gets out more and more to the culture. It's a bit harder for them to do because they don't have the mainstream press behind them. So they have to continue doing what they can to put that message out there, freedom, an individual's freedom and responsibility, but they also have to realize that step by step is the way it will get done, not because they put in a president, for instance, who's libertarian.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. But I wanted to make that point about the Constitution because I think we've completely lost. Oh, by the way, I know what I wanted to say, David. It's kind of like it's the frog analogy where you don't just throw a frog into boiling water. You put them in, you know, lukewarm water or cool water, and you slowly turn up the heat. And that's kind of what's been happening. I highly recommend, since you brought it up, something you said made me think of this movie. There's a film called Agenda, Grinding America Down. I have a blog post about it, and the whole thing documents the communist agenda, and especially, you know, like you said, it was like fast forward, you know, they put the pedal to the metal over the past 60 years, although I would say it's probably about 100 years of progressivism, ever since Karl Marx, you know, kind of taking hold.
Right.
But the movie is excellent. It explains so much of what's going on today in our culture. So I just wanted to let everybody know that, so please check that out. You can find that at my blog. But David, so let's talk now about the political spectrum. So what exactly is it? And let's go right to left or however you want to explain it to the audience.
All right, well, let's just start with what would be considered the dichotomy of the spectrum.
Okay.
That would be the extreme left and right. What are the two things that really mark the two ends of it? And traditionally what was put there was fascism on the right and communism on the left. And then everyone was supposed to somehow fit in between those. Well, both fascism and communism are oppressive systems, and they both belong on the left. When you look at the spectrum from the viewpoint of enslavement on the left and freedom on the right. So we could say, let's start on the right, which the political system that most provides freedom for the individual is our constitutional republic, which is a democratic constitutional republic. Basically, you have the founding documents, which lay out the role of government, which simply comes down to protect the individual's rights to his quest for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and prevent individuals from harming each other in regards to that. And the protection, of course, of the U.S., the country from external forces. And so there you
Correct.
Have your military.
Right. And, so, that's where I think a lot of libertarians kind of fall off the reservation, in my own opinion. They neglect the fact that evil does exist in the world and we do need protection from enemies. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Go ahead, David. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not sure what their view is on military, but, I mean, I do believe that I think even Ron Paul, who, you know, was Republican, I mean, he still, I think he felt that the use of a military force was necessary, but not necessarily going around and being a police, being the police for the world. It isn't its purpose and it isn't its role. But anyway, so you get, all right, so we established that, the Constitution providing that, and that's really all the government, the basic foundation of the government is based on. Then everything else gets added in there, and it's been added to and added to and added to and added to. If we were to just simply start stripping back all the bad laws that have been put in place, we would actually regain more freedom.
Yeah.
When a constitutional republic like ourselves begins to deteriorate, it actually starts, and this occurs when people start becoming or wanting to become more dependent. Those who have the mind of being dependent think in terms of, well, I can get something from the government. And when you work with the majority, when you start getting into this, oh, let me back up for a second. One of the things that would have prevented this majority rule attitude of, you know, give me more money that is currently occurring in our society, the Constitution set up a government where the Senate was actually supposed to be appointed by the states. The Senate was not supposed to be a popular vote. So we have the president who's put in by popular vote. You have the Senate, which is supposed to be assigned by the states. That protected the states' interests and the states' rights. And then you had the House, which, of course, represented the populace. So when you end up with all three of those branches of government being assigned by the populace through popular vote, then you now have opened up the door to this idea that, you know, if somebody wants something from a government, they can vote it in.
Yeah.
And it starts deteriorating down, because when you get into strict democracy, it is majority rule. It's mob rule. It's not rule based on necessarily the rights of the minority. Now, the difference in our society is that we have courts, which also look out and protect the minority. But that's different than democracy, because democracy is strictly majority rules. 51% can take away the rights of the 49%. So,
yeah.
So, and you can see that we're constantly referred to as a democracy, and that's what people keep promoting. And we've become more and more of a democracy as our system has been changed over the years. So we deteriorate down into a democracy. People begin to vote more and more for government to take care of them. Now we're moving down into socialism. So our government grows to cover all the requirements and requests of the citizens. And as it grows, it requires more money from those who are producing. And it continues to deteriorate until you get basically into a democratic socialism. So it's controlled by the group, the majority.
And that's kind of what we see in Europe, correct, David? Like Europe.
Yeah, and we're seeing it here now more than ever. I mean, we're not totally there, but it's certainly moving in that direction.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the next step down the scale was one of the most interesting ones that I came across as I was doing my research. I was looking at fascism and reading about, and I wanted to find out why fascism actually came about. I kept searching for that specific point. And I finally came across that Mussolini's purpose, a reason for bringing fascism to Italy, was to eliminate communism and socialism. That was his whole purpose. That's what he put out there. And when you look at that, as our society drifts down more and more into socialism, the people who are productive, who don't want to move in that direction, who see it destroying the country, get more and more upset, more and more angry about the situation. And then it just sets up a situation for someone to come in at some point with a strong fist and say, we're not going to take it anymore. And we lose again. We drift down further away from freedom. the freedom of speech gets eliminated completely by anyone who speaks communist or socialist rule, you know, ideas or what have you. And that, though that may be like, yes, that's fine with me, you know, people would have that viewpoint, it still reduces the freedoms of our country. It violates our basic tenets of free speech. So at that point, it doesn't matter because it's gone so far and people are behind it. And the dictator takes over, and now you get some of the freedoms back. If you were a productive person, property owner, you get all that back. If you were a communist, socialist, there's a large amount of injustice that occurs at that point. The solutions that some of the solutions that were perhaps put in place to help people who are indigent are eliminated. People who are strongly for socialism and communism who put it there might be physically eliminated as well, either imprisoned or killed, as was done in Italy.
Right.
So.
Oh, right. Yeah, there was one reporter in particular, now I can't remember his name, David, maybe you know, there was an Italian reporter who was reporting the truth about Mussolini. I remember watching this on a History Channel special, and he was like either gunned down, he was killed. I don't remember if he was gunned down or stabbed to death, but you know, that's what fascism does.
Absolutely. It's a system based on anger and hate, and if you're in the way of it, you're in danger, and if you're not, then you're fine. You can operate within it. The there was a point I was going to make there. I'm sorry.
That's my fault.
That's okay.
Differing degrees of enslavement. Is how I'm envisioning this. Now we're talking about fascism, and as we're moving towards the left of the spectrum, certainly communism is at the furthest left. Correct?
That's correct. Yeah. At least let's put it that way. This way, it's the furthest left that we name as a system, I suppose.
Okay.
There may be something further left of that, but it could be. And even in communism, you have different degrees of abusiveness, oppression, and what have you. You know, it's an interesting thing that when I've looked across the whole spectrum and I look at all the various different systems, a lot of it has to do with the intentions of the leaders. For instance, communism, it wasn't started necessarily by, you know, a government figure. Well, Karl Marx, you know, had this whole system, but the system of communism actually was a religious system where when you have a group of people who have common purpose, join together as a group and support each other. And that you can find that type of system throughout all over the planet, really.
Right, but isn't the difference, let me point this out, I'll play devil's advocate, isn't the difference there that people willingly, I mean, for example, we could point to a kibbutz in Israel where you could say that that's quote-unquote communism, but people are free to be part of it or not. They're
exactly.
free to join
and
it or not.
Exactly, it's freedom of choice.
Okay, right.
See, when you get into where the oppression begins, what if just as an example, let's just say you freely entered into one of these systems and you could freely exit. Well, what if at some point the leaders of that system became more and more oppressive and became, you see what I mean? It really becomes the intentions of the leaders. So I don't want to, like, It's an area that I've been examining a little bit in terms of all these different systems. And for instance, let's go back up to a republic, and then you go, well, there's no place in the republic for care of people. Well, and that's true if you look at government, but it isn't necessarily true because you do have religious organizations. You do have just the nature of man to help other
right.
people. So. Anyway.
And John Stossel, the journalist, has proven that private charity, private churches, religious organizations have done more to help other, to pull up individuals, help them in whatever regard there is than government ever could. And they do it with their own money. They raise their funds privately. And most people, I think, are charitable by nature. They do want to help. And by government getting involved, it just completely turns that whole thing on its head. And everybody's,
right.
you know, so go ahead. I just had to interject for a second.
No, and you're absolutely right, and that's the point. The intention of, say, religious organization isn't doing it for their own power. They aren't doing it for their own good. They're doing it to help others. So, again, it's the intention, it's a responsibility for one's fellow man. When you drop down further and further to the left, you lose that. You're getting more of a selfish type government. As we go from fascism, and when I was mentioning how a lot of injustice occurs during the takeover of fascism for the people who were on the left, they don't all get killed. They get suppressed, they get oppressed, and as time goes on, there's more and more discontent within the society, and then of course communism is in there, sprouting their propaganda about the elite class and the workers and workers' rise, and eventually the system will collapse into communism. If you look at World War II, it was interesting to me to look at it from this viewpoint, because if we hadn't stepped in and done our part in World War II, and if Russia had actually had the opportunity, I think Russia would have been happy to take over as much of Europe as possible.
Of course.
Under its yoke. And you see how the system of the Nazis and the fascists basically deteriorated, and half of the Nazis ended up under communism's yoke. So there's
right.
an example of it deteriorating down to the final system where you're all but a slave.
Right, and we certainly confined Eastern Europe to slavery under communism with the Warsaw Pact, and I'm only sorry when you look back at history that we didn't just continue the job and eradicate communism while we were at it, but I digress.
Yeah, yeah, well, they quote-unquote were our allies at the time. And,
right. Yeah, I guess war makes strange bedfellows. But, you know, David, you hit on something, and I want to make sure we emphasize this point, too. I think one of the things that communism, and we could even call it liberalism in this country, they like to play on people's emotions and their heartstrings. And we were talking about private charity and helping other people that need a hand up. I certainly don't think making them slaves to the government is doing them any good whatsoever. But there's this fallacy. There's this romantic notion of communism as, oh, everybody's equal and everybody, you know, to each according to his need, all this blah, blah, blah. Well, no, that's not true, because you have an elite class at the top that's, you know, living the life of Riley while everyone else is oppressed. And even if they're not losing their life, but certainly in Russia, I mean, how many millions of peasants were killed in terror famines between Lenin and Stalin? I mean, the number's incomprehensible. But even if it's not that extreme, you still have your elite class at the top that's living high off the hog. They're not suffering the way the rest of the population is under that sort of a system.
That's true. Communism is based on materialism, which basically denies God and denies anything spiritual. So you would expect from communism that the most important thing to them would be material things, which is... It's very interesting when you look at their definition of equality, or at least their application of equality, it's, does everybody have the same stuff? You know, it's that to them equals equality. They don't see the spiritual nature of man and the fact that people are different.
Right.
There are beings who are more knowledgeable. There are beings who are more compassionate. There's individuality, and they're trying to make everything the same through the materials that people have. So everyone wears the same clothes, everyone has the same kind of housing. It's extremely boring. It's, you know, so that's one thing that you can say about it that's most obvious, is that it's boring.
Well, at best it's boring, at worst it's life endangering. I mean, I watched a series called The Bloody History of Communism to do research for a book that I'm ghostwriting. And
mm-hmm.
between Lenin and Stalin, I mean, these peasants, they starved them to death. They took away their farm equipment. They confiscated their land. They took away all of their food, and they basically wanted to turn people into savages. I mean, that's a direct quote from Stalin himself, and also based on Charles Darwin. I mean, you mentioned God. I mean, the fallacy of Darwinism also fed the beast of communism in the 20th century.
Absolutely. So, yeah, and that's one of the things you find, of course, on the far right, is that the further right you would go on the spectrum, you would have more and more tolerance of religion and between religions and not, you know, in practice. And so you naturally go more toward the goodness of man when you're going to the right, and when you're going to the left, you're going toward that bestiality that you would find under these concepts of man is an animal, and he rose from matter. And anyway, it's a ridiculous argument because it can be proven 100,000 times over how it couldn't be possible for that to occur. When you look at if you look at matter, any piece of matter right in front of you now, you say, well, what's the difference between that and me? Well, I can get ideas that matter can't. Ideas don't spring from matter. Ideas spring from the spiritual nature of man. So.
Exactly. And, you know, and if you believe in God or a higher power, then you as an individual also believe that you're here for a purpose, that higher power or God or whoever you look at it put you here to accomplish things that government has no right to interfere in.
Absolutely. And that's what our Constitution was based on, that basic belief. So anyway, I think we've skirted across the spectrum there. One of the things I was looking at recently was this idea of class, the social classes. And when you look at the social classes on the way down, let's just say all the way to the left, basically you have really, quote-unquote, a single class. It's not really, because like you said, and which is obvious to anybody, even in communism, is that there's a ruling class and then everyone else is peasants. But they're all, quote-unquote, fellow comrades, which is supposed to be the everyone is the same class. And as you move up from there, one of the things I realized was that the United States is probably, with the founding documents we have, it set a foundation for, like, the most classless society that you could have. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and freedom, the pursuit of happiness. It's not something that's just granted to a few people. And as you look at the application of that in the phrase, all men are equal under the law, that's the actual application of that fact. And when that factor is applied to society, you do have class. Social class doesn't mean anything. I mean, you can look at class from a viewpoint of maybe people's income, and that's really all they're doing. But there's nothing that's saying you can't move up that income scale if you were to get more able, become more creative. Mm-hmm. If you can rise as far as you want. Some people don't want to do that. I mean, there are people who want to be beach bums. And if that's what they want to be, then that's what they can be.
Right.
If someone wants to be president, he can go through the steps he thinks he needs to do to become president, and he could become president. Or he could be both a beach bum and president.
Right.
And, you know, it's the choice is there. It's a freedom of choice, as you're over here on the far right under freedom.
Right. And the thing is, too, you shouldn't demand, if your choice is to be a beach bum, then you have no, and that's your choice, nobody's forcing you to be a beach bum, you have no right to demand that the government take from somebody who chooses to be a successful entrepreneur who's lifted himself up by his bootstraps and created something that people want in the marketplace. You have no right to demand that the government raise his taxes and give that money to you. If you are choosing to be a beach bum, that is your choice. I think that's, you know, I think left out of this equation in our current culture, David, and as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this, it's the concept of personal responsibility and taking control of your own life, whether that means you need to take classes, whether that means you need to get a second job, maybe you have a desire to do something, but you got to support yourself in the meantime. Well, flip burgers and write your book at night, you know, kind of thing. But
right.
Don't demand that government somehow make life fair. It just doesn't work that way. Can you?
No, it doesn't. And it will never work. And even if someone tries to put a system there that will try to create that falsity, it doesn't work. One of the things that I find extremely interesting is the way societies are brought down, and that's basically through the education system. A person does need to learn. He does need to learn the basics of learning, even. How does he know? How does he read? You know, write? How does he express his views? And when basic education is denied to a person, as it is really in our society, because even though we have schools and what have you, students aren't being taught the basics of what our society is based on. They're being taught more of a socialist agenda than they are basically what a society based on freedom depends on. And people will give up freedom for security. And that's one of the things that is used mostly to take away people's freedoms. situations occur, and then we try to take away some more freedoms to protect you. And then another situation occurs, and we take away some more freedoms to protect you. And eventually it deteriorates down to a point where we can't protect ourselves anymore.
Right. Well, David, you know, now let me take a step back with the education component, because obviously we want people to be educated. But from a constitutional perspective, the Federal Department of Education is completely unconstitutional. And in my opinion, and I want to get your opinion, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, or what your thoughts on the matter are, is that either education should be managed by each individual state or privatized altogether. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it certainly shouldn't be federal. I think states certainly should perhaps be involved in it, but I think there's enough people who love being teachers, whether it's a private or, you know, through churches or what have you, that, you know, people of goodwill want other people to succeed. So we had education, I mean, before the federal government controlled our education system, we had people like Thomas Jefferson. It doesn't require a one system fits all controlled by a federal government, which obviously can exert a lot of influence on what's being taught.
Exactly. And
that's
totally
the danger of it.
Right, and we're seeing it today. I mean, look, a lot of these public schools have become social engineering experiments for left-wing propaganda. I mean, against the parents' wishes, maybe their kid, instead of being taught in second grade, you know, basic arithmetic and multiplication tables, they're teaching them about homosexuality, whether or not the parents want that. So, you know, and our tax dollars are being used to perpetuate this nonsense.
Right, and that was the point, actually, now that I recall, that I was going with fascism, because that's the direction that Mussolini went with. He went with that idea of, if you control the children, you control the next
right.
generation, you control the direction society goes. Well, whether you call that communism or fascism, it's
well, yeah, that was Lenin and Stalin as well.
Yes, both of them do that. I mean, because that's
right.
what you have to do. You have to do that because it's not the natural bent of people to go in that direction. People will tend to go more toward independence and freedom than they will, unless they're indoctrinated into a system by government that this is the way it should be, and this is the way everybody thinks, and this is what's being good. If you do this, you're good, and if you don't, you're bad. And when it starts young, I mean, you believe the things you are told when you're a child. You trust that what you're being instructed on, you trust what your parents tell you is true, until either it's A, you've become wise to lies, or it's too late and you've been indoctrinated into a system that doesn't make any sense and you can't really think with what's
right. Well, and in the American school system too currently, David, I mean, kids are not being taught the truth about our founding fathers. I mean, I stated at the top of the show that they were men, they were not perfect, they did something absolutely miraculous in the history of the world by creating a constitutional republic in which the individual reigns supreme. But what kids are being fed in public schools, for the most part, are that the founding fathers were all racist. They don't explain, and we talked about this earlier, the issue of having to sort of fight one battle at a time. They couldn't remain united as colonies and deal with the issue of slavery. I mean, it just was impossible at the time, and they needed all the states on board in order to make independence happen. I mean, they had to win their independence first. But that's not really explained. Also, you know, with respect to the issue of slavery, and I would love to get your opinion on this too, you know, left out of the school curriculum is the fact that, you know, actual Africans sold their own people into slavery too. So they're guilty as well. But we never hear that side of the story.
No, that's true. And there was also black slaveholders as well in the United States. So, but, you know, it was a system that should never have occurred, and, you know, it was eventually corrected. That really left, if you look at the black society and you look at them on the political spectrum of enslavement through freedom, you can see why you get a lot of this. They're working their way back from the left toward the right within a society that held them, you know, in enslavement. It's not one of those things that can be erased overnight. So there's, you know, you kind of sometimes hear people still upset about it, and you kind of go, why don't you get over it? You weren't involved with it. But, you know, family to family, that same antagonism, that same hate and pain that occurred during those times does move from family to family, and so it's going to take a while for the Black community to move through that.
Well,
but I think that it's happening, and it will happen as long as we move the country and keep the country and invite them and include them in our freedoms.
Well, that's very true. But, I mean, let's look at this from another perspective. I mean, look at all the Black constitutional conservatives who are absolutely vilified in the media by outlets like MSNBC and CNN. They're called Uncle Toms. You know, Black people who believe in the United States Constitution, who understand that slavery was a blight in our country, it's over. They want to participate. They are free citizens, and they're absolutely maligned. Meanwhile, now, our modern-day version of slavery is to keep them in government dependency.
Right. Well, see, that's all being propagated by the left anyway. So, I mean, that's not surprising to you or to me. Our quote-unquote mainstream media is left-wing propaganda. There's no doubt about it. And it's even when they occasionally say something nice about freedom and personal responsibility, if you rarely hear that, it's always got caveats attached to it. And but that's what I'm saying. You have Blacks who are involved in this society from the viewpoint of freedom and individual responsibility. There's a lot of them. Even a lot of them that are Democrats are that way, but they're still, like you said, they're still kind of, to me, I just look at it as they're moving across the spectrum. More and more of them are waking up to what real freedom is, and that our Constitution gives the best possible opportunity for them and their families to be free and to pursue happiness. So, I mean, it's a shame when you look in cities like Detroit where they're run by these left-wing governments that just oppress them, and there's no hope for these people. They don't get educated, and what do? They end up being gangs, and they end up shooting each other.
Right.
It's a terrible loss to our society, and I think that if government were moved out of those areas and religious organizations moved into those areas to help them, you'd see a big change.
Oh, absolutely. It's really sad. It's horrible. It's just heartbreaking what's happened to American cities as a result of left-wing policies, the union stranglehold on everything. I think Detroit's a great example of that, also Philadelphia. And they're not doing these people any favors. And certainly, you know, people who are stuck, whether they're Black or white or whatever race they are, people who are stuck in these neighborhoods where there's all kinds of drug-related violence and gang violence, we have a lot of innocent people who can't defend themselves because they've got strict gun control laws in places like Chicago. And, you know, they're suffering. They truly are. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more that private enterprise and private charities and more churches and religious organizations are what's needed to pull these cities out of this kind of depravity that they're in right now.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, it makes me really, really sad. But that was my point, you know, just getting back to the whole education. Because, again, if we don't learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it. And, again, our history obviously is not perfect. But when you look at history of the world and the governmental systems that were in place up until our founding father said, we're going to create a constitutional republic, I mean, we are head and shoulders above the crowd, even with all of our faults. And my point in bringing that up was that students are not being taught the whole picture. Meanwhile, they're glorifying people like Mao, you know, another one responsible for the murder of tens of millions of his own people. They glorify Stalin. They glorify Lenin. People like Che Guevara. I mean, Beyonce and her husband there, Jay-Z, just went to Cuba on a vacation. Do you know what? Blacks are being imprisoned in Cuba. Talk about racism and slavery. They're enslaved there. And yet,
but they're very smart about these things, the left are. I mean, again, all this is propaganda from the left, but I mean, a lot of the Blacks that were involved in the Communist Party in our own country here were invited to Russia back in the 50s, taken over there, shown a false idea of what quote-unquote equality looked like, and they bought it. And they've hated America, you know, ever since, and have been working to destroy it. And same thing with these guys. You know, they're buying this. They're buying the public relations, the propaganda, and it really is that. It doesn't bother me that much that these people go there. I don't listen to them anyway. I see what they're doing. I see how they're being influenced. And, you know, it does obviously they do it with these celebrities because that, quote unquote, influences a lot of young minds who follow these people. So it's, you know, it's a terrible thing, but it is what they're doing. And when you recognize it, I'd like to say one last thing is that one of the things that the communists hate the most is being exposed. Once a person opens their mouth and starts talking about, for instance, Alan West brought up how the Progressive Caucus in the U.S. Congress are basically communists. And he lost his seat from that. They campaigned against him, and from the data I have also falsified the statistics of the voting. But this is a thing that they can't afford to have happen. And I've stressed continually when I speak with people in positions where they can do this is to uncover and show who the communists are. And I'll tell you what, it's not always the people who are talking. They're always behind those people. The real communists are cowards. They cannot come out in the open because they cannot be seen. They cannot be, because if you saw who it was, that's why they hide behind these terms like progressive, liberal, what have you, because if they came out and just said we're communists and we're pushing the communist agenda, it would turn off all these people that are behind them.
Right.
Right away. Mm-hmm. Because people know what communism is. But when it comes up, when they come out with this step-by-step, progressive step, you know, here's a disaster, let's take away more gun rights, they hit the emotions, as you said, and they create those problems. You see what I mean?
Sure. Oh, it's all emotional manipulation. Of course, they cannot be upfront about what they are. And you could even, in American politics, it's the same thing. Even if, and I agree with Alan West. I mean, there are avowed communists in our government, absolutely, for sure. Maxine Waters is one of them. But even those who maybe aren't necessarily that far to the left, you know, they always have to kind of run to the center when we have elections, because if they were honest about their real intentions, most people would reject it outright.
Exactly.
So you're absolutely correct.
Yep.
And that's why, David, too, I think that the whole notion of political parties has just completely destroyed this country, because Alan West, I mean, unfortunately, and I believe this to be the case, I think the Republican Party is the biggest obstacle to freedom right now, because at least when you have somebody on the left, you kind of know where they stand based on their
right.
voting record. And they'll, one thing I will grant them, and I want you to jump back in here, in our government, they will fight like hell for what they want. They will go to the mat. They don't beat themselves on the chest and say, oh, we lost an election. Oh, maybe we need to pander to this group or that group. You know, why don't they just pander to the Constitution? But, you know, they don't do that. They fight like hell for what they believe. And that's one thing I have to respect about them. Our side, we have people who are supposedly in the party that upholds the Constitution who are all too eager to just make these deals that keep taking us further and further down the left side of the spectrum.
Right. Well, you go back to the communist agenda, and their intention was to infiltrate both political parties in the United States. Well, it may or may not be the people we elect, but there's a lot of people behind these people who give them advice. And you can bet that the Communist Party is well entrenched into the Republican Party as well, doing what they do.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. It's what we can't see, and you're so right, David, when you say that. It's the people we can't see that are influencing them that are the real danger.
Right. And when they come up with these generalities that the people want this, the people want that, large percentage of the people are looking at this, then the elected officials, even on the Republican side, may or may not be involved with them directly, but they certainly are influenced by them. And then you get people like Paul Ryan, my congressman, forget his name, the senator. The guy from Cuba. These guys are not letting, they're aware of these things. They're aware of the communist agenda. So that's why they sound different. They're not taking advice from these same people. And then, of course, they're being attacked because of it. And one last thing on the Alan West point. If you look at all the press release that occurred after Alan West spoke of the communists in the Progressive Caucus, there isn't one denial, not a single denial that they are communists.
Wow.
They're all just, all they do is they turn around and attack him for saying that. I've looked at denials, and there was none. They were all like, Alan West is crazy. He's McCarthyism. McCarthy was probably the best thing that ever happened to the communists, because now every time someone mentions the word communism, they can say, hey, there's Joe McCarthy.
Well, you know what? My grandfather was a staunch supporter of Joe McCarthy and my mother, and I grew up with the belief that the man was a patriot. And it turned out that he was absolutely right. So, I wish more people, especially, you know, those who hold office on the Republican side, would stand out in defense of Joseph McCarthy, because in my mind, the man's a patriot.
Yeah, well, and again, they use that as, you know, as a bad word.
Yeah, no, and you're absolutely right. I mean, and that's a classic example of how they take the language and, you know, now it's McCarthyism and it's got this negative connotation.
Right.
Despite the fact that the man was vindicated after his death and it turned out that he was absolutely correct.
Yeah, now I don't know his methods. I never really studied what he did. Whether he, you know, did it correctly or not, I don't know. I don't see any reason why we need to outlaw communism. I just think we need to expose it, because when people know what it is, they have no interest in it. That's why they have to hide. That's why they have to be progressive.
Exactly. It's an inherently flawed system, so you're right. Just expose it to daylight, make people aware of exactly what it is, and it'll die on its own.
Exactly. And meanwhile, keep creating our own republic. Keep putting what it should be here and making it what it should be. That's the most important part, because what they're doing is creating their socialist agenda. Do we have our own agenda to keep moving our system back more and more toward the freedoms that the Founding Fathers envisioned? I think that's the most important thing we can all do, is if we stop creating it, which is what seems to have happened, because no one's teaching it has been teaching it for years, it's going to get lost even if nothing else happens. So we have to know our Constitution. We have to understand all these aspects of our own government and why it was established the way it was and what it grants us and what it grants governments as power.
Right, exactly. Well, David, in the last, we have about 4 minutes, so I want to make sure that we put a plug in for your book, let people know where they can find it, let us know about your website, and tell me, you know, just maybe briefly too, in your own words, what are some practical steps that people can take to help return our government to its proper place?
Well, the immediate one is getting involved in local politics. I mean, you can sit there and worry about Washington, D.C., but you really can't do a whole lot. You can keep informed and you can work with your representatives, but they're not just operating on the federal level, they're operating on the local levels as well. So the thing is, get involved with your local politics. Know who's running, or if you have a mind to, run yourself, and get in there and start backing up the Constitution. It applies right there in your hometown. And you'll find that there are people even in your own hometown that are moving the local governments toward the left, becoming more and more imposing on the individuals, homeowners, and what have you. So that's what I would say the most practical thing to do. But you could take the whole communist agenda, and you could look at points in there on education, religion, and you could, anywhere that you have a sphere of influence, you could affect that. And that's covered in the book, by the way.
Excellent. So tell us where we can find it, and tell us about your website as well.
All right. So the book can be purchased. The soft cover can be purchased on Amazon.com, and the ebook can be gotten for Kindle, Nook, and iBooks from the various stores that Amazon sells the Barnes & Noble sells the Nook copies, and of course, you get your iBooks from the iStore. And that's basically where it can be gotten. The website is thepoliticalspectrum.net. You can, all the links to the various different places you could buy the book are there. And there's also an interactive page which goes through the different political systems and also how the political spectrum applies to things like religion, the economy, showing how socialism and the free markets work. It's a very good interactive system, and someone can just kind of breeze through and learn a lot about how the spectrum works and how it affects everything in society.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I've been on there myself, David, and I highly recommend that my listeners please check that out and share it. That's the other thing that's important. Share it with everybody you know, and we've got to get away from this notion that somehow we're not supposed to discuss religion and politics, because I think that's also done a lot of damage. So check out David's website, thepoliticalspectrum.net. The book is called The Political Spectrum, Freedom versus Enslavement. And David, I also want to compliment you, because one thing you do very well, in addition to the book, is creating these videos that people can also find at the site, which are very informative.
Yeah, there's also a YouTube video under the same name that I recently posted, which is not on my site yet. But if you just look up the political spectrum, freedom versus enslavement, on YouTube, you'll find about a 17-minute long video that describes and goes through the whole political spectrum.
Oh, fantastic. I'm gonna find that myself and post it on my own blog and make sure I share that with my social media contacts.
That would be great.
Yeah, awesome. Well, David, I want to thank you for being such a great guest and for writing such an important book. And I'm going to look into maybe booking you for my Saturday night show, and I will definitely be in touch on that.
That sounds great. I look forward to it. And thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
You too, Daria. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was David R. Young. Please visit his site, thepoliticalspectrum.net. Purchase his book. It is educational. Share it with everybody you know. I personally believe it's the only way we're going to get this country back on track is by neighbors reaching out to neighbors, family members reaching out to family, and starting to discuss all of these important topics, because our freedom is eroding, and it's time that we all do something about it. Okay, I see that my next guest is on the switchboard, but I'm going to go ahead and take a little break here before I bring on the author of A Pious Man novel, a holy thriller, which is an awesome, awesome book. So hang in there with me, Declan Finn. I will be with you in just a moment after this brief commercial break.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Rightstream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES for details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the Rightstream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. Rightstream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics.
We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/writestream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday WriteStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag WriteStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the WriteStream Radio Network and the WriteStream Twitter chat.
All right, and we are back. And without further ado, I'm going to welcome to WriteStream Tuesday Declan Finn, author of A Pious Man and a Holy Thriller. Oh, my gosh, I'm like losing my mind here. Welcome to WriteStream.
Thank you. Don't worry about losing your mind. I lost mine years ago.
Now, before we go any further, now, am I pronouncing your first name correctly?
Declan.
Declan. Okay, yeah. I just wanted to make sure. Perfect. So, Declan, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today. I really enjoyed your book, as you know, wrote a review of it on my blog. And so let me just give you an opportunity here to kind of just introduce yourself to the audience, and then we'll get into some of the aspects of the book and the writing process.
Well, Declan Finn, 32. This is my third novel. The first one was pretty much a test run. Second one, which was a science fiction novel where there were a lot of dead politicians by the end of it. came out February, called Codename Winterborn. And this one, A Pious Man, is actually a book 9 years in the making that was, I have a few degrees in history before I realized that, oh, look, you're taking modern European history. Your degree is useless. But I wound up taking a graduate paper and turning it into a very long trilogy.
Well, first of all, congratulations, because I had no idea that this was your third novel. I mean, that is what a fantastic accomplishment. And it certainly was an entertaining and enlightening read. And you've combined Catholic conspiracy theories with history, with a thrilling kind of a story, with like a whodunit where you don't know, and all these great characters. So now I understand, because you have a history background. But Declan, I know you and I have talked on other platforms about this on Twitter and Facebook. Was part of your motivation for writing the book to sort of clear up some misconceptions concerning World War II and a certain pope?
Oh, yes. I had done my graduate paper on Pope Pius XII, commonly known as Hitler's Pope, for the last 15 years or so. So, and originally, it really didn't bother me until I started reading more into the actual background, going through primary documents. And, by the time I was done with the research, I was so vehement about making sure this was proven to my satisfaction in just a grad paper that, there were family members who listened to me for a few minutes and said, Torquemada lives! Believe it or not, I was not inspired to write the book even when I was done with the paper. But I wound up coming across another novel, very similar in premise to the usual evil Catholic Church, evil Nazi Catholics, blah, 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 snore. Wake me when you get to something interesting. Unfortunately, I went to the back of the book because all these names he was using in the course of the story, and I'm not going to say which author, I don't want to get sued, but all the names he was using were historical. I knew these names. So I went to the back of the book. It's like, I read this book, I read this book, I read all these books. And he's using, quote-unquote, facts that are complete lies. And he's even saying in the author's notes, these are facts, these are real details. No, they're not. In fact, some of these stories are completely contradicted by people who think Pope Pius XII was a Nazi. The heck with people who think he was a hero, saint. Warrior for God, Catholic Militant for short. So it's like, wow, the heck with the Da Vinci Code, people will believe almost anything. So I started writing because, hey, more people are probably going to learn the truth from Tom Clancy novels or James Rollins novels than they will from history books. So that's how I got started on Pious Man, and it didn't let me go for a while.
Wow. No, that's fantastic. And, you know, you made such a great point, Declan, about the power of fiction because, you know, last week I interviewed author Harriet Park, and she wrote Agenda 21. And, you know, she said it's a fictional dystopia. It's a horrible vision of what life could be like if that UN policy is implemented. But she made the same point. She said, you know, I read through the actual document, the UN document. She said, how many people are really going to have the patience to do that? So I wanted to create an entertaining story that would illustrate these truths that would hold people's attention. And I think the same thing is true, it sounds like, of your book. But I want to ask you, like, how did all these misconceptions, in your opinion and throughout your, you know, your research and as a student of history, what's the basis for all these misconceptions about Pope Pius and him being a Nazi or a Nazi enabler?
Well, journey back with me now to the glory days of 1963 with a writer whose name, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Rolf Hakuth. Look up the play called The Deputy. It was the first time anyone had even suggested that Pope Pius XII had been involved in gassing anyone, in the Holocaust, and even being involved with the Nazi regime. Now, it was written and put up 5 years after Pope Pius XII had died, which, great act of moral courage. Wait till a guy's cold in the ground.
He can't defend himself, right?
Exactly. And this guy was, Mr. Hakuth, was a Hitler youth. Sublimation and trying to put it off on somebody else? No, not at all. And what I found interesting, and this is something that was kind of terrifying, because in the novel, I wrote it 9 years ago, as I noted. I put down that, well, gee, he was part of a massive conspiracy. I threw in the Soviet Union. And then I found out a few years later, no, he was on the Soviet payroll, and he, which explains a lot of other plays. For example, he wrote an eight-hour play. Well, you know, leave it to the Germans to write eight-hour plays. Welcome to Wagner's Ring Cycle. He did an eight-hour play around blaming Churchill for all of World War II.
And, oh, no.
Yeah, in that case, Hakuth used the real name of a real British pilot as the protagonist. Unfortunately for him, that British pilot was still breathing and said, this is complete BS. And so there went his writing career. But
right.
Since 1963, you've had various and sundry incarnations of Hitler's Pope, long before John Cornwell came out with his book in 98. And if you want me to go into motivations of why people might want to do that, that's, well, how many hours do you have?
No, not nearly enough, and I want to make sure that we plug your book and your work. But no, that is very enlightening to me, Declan, and thank you for mentioning that because I don't want to get too off on too much of a tangent here, but certainly in the wake of Pope Benedict's resignation this year and then the subsequent election of a new pope, I'm not going to say for the first time because I knew anti-Catholic bias existed. I guess for some reason it didn't bother me, or maybe I wasn't exposed to it in such a concentrated form, as you have with Facebook and with Twitter. But I was absolutely stunned by people that I considered my friends and what they really believed about Catholicism and the Pope and Catholics in general. And I'm thinking, that's not true. And that they present them, just like this author you're talking about, that of this play, as absolute fact. And people just, I just cannot tell you how disappointed I've been. So that was one of the reasons I'm so thrilled to be able to talk to you on RightStream today.
Okay.
And
well,
go ahead.
I first knew something was fishy as far as anti-Catholic bias was concerned when Benedict was first elected. He was in the office for about 5 minutes when BBC started dubbing him the Panzer Pope, Nazi, etc. And all I could think was, wait, Joseph Ratzinger, was in the seminary at age 12. When he was 14, he was drafted into the Hitler Youth at gunpoint and ran away as soon as he could. Wow, some people really need to crack open a history book and not Dan Brown.
Yeah, exactly, Declan. No, it's so true. I mean, there's no regard whatsoever for the fact that the Nazi regime, that wasn't optional. when you're staring down the barrel of a gun, I guess you do what you're told, and then you survive until you can find a way to escape. And I'm so glad that we have this opportunity to clear up, Pope Benedict's reputation on this little program, because I plan on sharing it on Facebook with some of these people who need the education. But that's so true. And then by the same token, I have also seen the ugly bigotry of people who, getting back to Pope Pius, who absolutely refused to believe that the man was not complicit in helping the Nazis, nor was he a Nazi himself or a Nazi sympathizer or in any way a fan of the Nazis. And in fact, there's a book, I believe, coming out this month or next month that kind of debunks all of that. And I shared a link with it in one of my Facebook groups. And, immediately people were saying, oh, that's BS. It's like they want to believe the worst in spite of the evidence. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to dominate here.
Oh, no. Go right ahead. I'm quite happy. but as far as people who want to believe, it gives them, I believe it was G.K. Chesterton who once said, any stigma to beat a dogma. And in this case, yes, we're going to keep calling Catholics Nazis because if we don't use these ad hominem or ad institutional attacks, good God, maybe they will actually have to have an intellectual debate about what Catholics believe. They might actually have to have a discussion about abortion, contraception. Pick a topic in the last 50 years that the Catholic Church has been on the quote-unquote wrong side of. Now, it's, oh, well, hey, you guys support Nazis. We don't have to listen to you. And it's intellectually lazy, but it gives them something to cling to.
Right. Well, it's also, in light of, and I'm glad you brought up abortion and birth control, in light of the all-out assault on religious freedom that we are experiencing right now in this country with religious institutions and Christians in general being forced to financially support things they don't believe in, like birth control coverage and abortion coverage, you would think that all Christians would understand, hey, we better band together because we got a common enemy here. We don't have to agree on dogma. We don't have to agree with what we all believe, but we should certainly agree that we have a common enemy and we have a right to our own beliefs. And that's, I think, why it was so disturbing to me as well, because, we got a bigger enemy here, and I think we all need to band together.
Unfortunately, you've got a problem. Well, I say you. I mean, the country's got a problem in terms of, look at the Catholic Church in the United States. For the most part, for at least 100 years, it's been considered a wholly owned subsidiary of the Democratic Party, despite the fact that for at least 40 years, the Catholic Church teaches one thing, and the, a belief in Jesus, the guy hanging on the 2x4s. And on the other hand, you have the Democratic Party, who seem to be worshiping Moloch, where, oh, look, let's sacrifice children. Let's prevent the birth of children. And between the two, you would have thought that somebody would have figured out, oh, look, there's a great big disparity here. But nobody seems to be clicking to it, or at least they haven't been, for decades. And I think it's only been recently where even Catholic bishops have clued in on, maybe we can't believe everything Democratic politicians tell us.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, that is so true. I remember, you know, growing up, my mother was staunchly conservative, and, you know, I went all through Catholic school, and my mother was very involved in volunteering with local politics, and, you know, there was a local politician who was famously pro-abortion, and the nuns would all vote the big D, you know, because they had this perception that, again, I don't want to go off the reservation here too much, but, you know, let me just say this, and then I want to get back to your book. You know, that quote-unquote Democrats helped poor people and Republicans were for rich people. You know, and that's a whole other misconception we could spend an hour on. But you're absolutely right. There's certainly been a dichotomy or a complete disconnection between beliefs and how that actively translates in the real world.
Oh, yeah.
So, Declan, let's talk about a Pious Man novel. So you
sure.
say now this has been 9 years in the making?
Yep. Part of it was my own fault. I was trying to go and get my quote-unquote fallback position. I got a master's in history. I was going to go for a PhD. Then I realized that the area I've been focusing on for years was zero employment because, as Thomas Jefferson once famously said about the Supreme Court, none retire and few die.
Right.
Welcome to academia. And I wound up holding off from 04 to 07. And for the last 6 years, I've burned out two agents, several publishing companies, and then I just said, oh, to heck with it. There's this nice thing called CreateSpace. I'm going to go with that.
Excellent. You know, I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, I like to talk about this with all of my authors on WriteStream, and that is that I think the stigma of being, quote-unquote, a self-published author has gone away. It's taken a while, and certainly new technology and all these advances that we've seen have sort of democratized the whole process where you don't have to go through the gatekeepers anymore. I mean, it's pretty much revolutionized publishing.
Oh, yes, although it hasn't really revolutionized it enough. Because you look at publish-on-demand technology, and, hey, I can publish a book from pretty much anywhere in the United States. And yet, most of the publishing companies are based in either New York or Los Angeles, which, last time I checked, to steal a phrase from Sean Hannity, we have the highest taxes in the universe!
Right.
I wonder how much the cost of books would go down if they moved to anywhere else, really.
Yeah, fly over country, somewhere. Yeah, seriously. That is such an excellent point. And why are they concentrated in those types of high rent districts or areas, do you think?
I would only imagine because the industry has been there for at least 100 years, you'd think, in some cases. And moving would probably hasn't even occurred to them. Oh, look. We can go to the Waldorf Astoria. We can go to Central Park just by going a few blocks. Why should we go to someplace dirty like Vermont? It has trees.
Yeah. Gotcha. So, you know, getting back to the actual writing process, though, and I want to talk, we'll get back to the agents and why you decided to go create space in a minute, but, you know, you have so many rich characters in a Pious Man novel. I mean, I was so impressed as I was reading, and the way that you were able to, like, to pace the story and switch kind of back and forth between, you know, these two characters and then switch to these two characters, and they don't always know, they're not all involved with each other all the time, and I wanted to talk about that process and how you conceived of that whole idea and the plot itself.
Well, the plot came kind of easily to me to start with because I knew where the setting had to be. It had to be in Rome, in the Vatican. I knew I had to start with a bang, which is why I blow up a hotel. And I knew certain parties had to be involved, like, oh, look, we just blew up a hotel in front of the Vatican. Let's bring in the Swiss guards. And there were some elements where, yes, I should bring an outsider where we have to explain this stuff to, because most of my target audience in the Catholic Church, even in my local parish, wouldn't get some of the obscure Catholic doctrine I was using. So, okay, we need outsiders. So, arbitrary and capricious, let's grab an American Jewish American duchess, as she likes to call herself, and someone from Egypt to get a completely different perspective. I knew, okay, we've got the Holocaust. We're going to need the Israelis to come in. And since the Israelis get a lot of information from, wonder of wonders, Germany, bring in somebody from there as well. And as for the writing process, this was actually so complex that this was the first book I ever had to outline. Most of the time, I develop my characters, I give them full biographies, and by the time I'm done, I usually hear them in my head. Welcome to being a writer. A legal form of multiple personality disorder.
That's so true.
You know, and after that, it's I set the stage and I let them go and play. Which is, in one case, with one character, the primary bad guy, the man just wouldn't die. Which is why the entire book, which is why it's a trilogy. It's, okay, I'm going to do this to him. He doesn't stay dead. I'm going to try this. I did everything but throw him under a train. Which probably would have been the next step.
Did you have a favorite character that you enjoyed writing, or did you kind of feel equally about all of them?
I enjoyed all of them. Each individual quirk for each character. You know, but your audience does not, that I have one character, a Scott Mossad Murphy, where his running gag is, funny, you don't look Jewish. And, you know, he's the perfect spy, gray little man, you know, hi, I'm not here, you do not see me, I am not the droids you're looking for. And I paired him up with somebody who was more or less out of Bond Girl central casting, and it's, good God, everybody's going to be looking at us. God, I want to disappear in the background, and I can't. She's right next to me. And he was so fun to play with because, you know, the female agent I put him with saw his discomfort, and whenever she was even slightly flirtatious or could be even remotely considered flirtatious, and then she did it just to razz him, and it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, but it was little things like that for everybody.
Yeah. Now, did you work on this? So it was over a period of 9 years. And how did, and I know you said it was the first book that you outlined. Mm-hmm. How, like, I guess, did you work on it every day? Like, how did it play out in terms of your daily writing?
Well, when I first wrote it, it was an 800-page monstrosity. I wrote over 4 months. And I.
Wow.
I would sit down, I would start writing, and eventually I would fall asleep. And, you know, every writer has, or at least every writer that I've heard of, seems to have a little black notebook where, oh, you know, we've got an idea in the middle of the night, we want to write it down, and then try to go back to sleep. In the case of A Pious Man, it wound up turning into the whole notebook.
So. Amazing. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So now, in terms of getting it published, you said you burned out on a couple of literary agents, so I assume you went that route at first, the idea of maybe going with a traditional publisher.
Oh, yes. I first started with, he was an apprentice agent at the time, Josh. I won't use his last name again. I don't want negative publicity. But
sure.
Josh was nice. He was supportive. He even helped a little bit on the ending to one of the books. And it's, okay, sorry, I'm an apprentice. I would love to use your book to become a real agent when he grows up. And he wound up saying, sorry, I can't really choose all my projects. I'm going to have to put you off for a year. A year later, sorry, I'm too busy, we can't play. Fine. Go on to another agent. Sam. Love the guy. Informative, considerate. Unfortunately, there were two problems. One, his major forte was nonfiction, which kind of helped considering the nature of the novel. however. But it was also the same year that Random House was firing tens of thousands of people a month. It was 08, 09.
Yeah.
So I had perfect timing.
Well, you know, there's been such a paradigm shift, and John Gresham, I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. He's my Military Monday host. I mean, he's been an author since the early 90s, and he spoke to that as well, that whole shift in the publishing industry. So it sounds as if, like, right around that time, you know, I'm sure that had a lot to do with the layoffs that were going on, because it's just everything has just changed, been revolutionized, at least from the standpoint of a traditional publishing house.
Oh, definitely. One of the things Sam told me about was he kept petitioning different editors at, I believe it was Doubleday, and he never ran out of editors. And I was with him for about 3 years. He never ran out of editors to petition or query because they kept going through on a revolving door policy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, so then somewhere along the line you said, okay, I've had enough of this, but I'm going to self-publish.
Mm-hmm.
And so now tell me, take us through the process of you deciding on your self-publisher. I mean, how did you decide on CreateSpace? Did you research others? Because there's so many of them out there now, too, and I think it's important to share this information with other writers who may be considering doing the same thing, and maybe, you know, sharing a little bit about the process you went through, the whole process of selecting a self-publishing company.
Well, with CreateSpace, it was kind of easy to pick because not only did they give good royalty, in terms of percentages, I mean,
mm-hmm.
It was also an Amazon affiliate. Since Amazon seems to be the biggest, baddest kid on the block in terms of selling books, it was pretty much a no-brainer. I figured I could go through something like Lulu.com, which is another one I am familiar with. Then you look at the price of producing books, and it's more, with Lulu.com, it's more of a traditional publishing house in terms of, yes, your book can be sold, your book can be produced at $4 a copy if, you know, you order 2,000 copies. You know,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
With CreateSpace, on the other hand, to produce a 283-page paperback, it's $4 and change, which means if I set it at $14.50, congratulations, I've got $5 because, of course, Amazon will take their share. And after that, okay, great, I've got money, as opposed to going
right
to Lulu, where it's, I might make a buck a book.
Okay, interesting. And even, you know, and it's so funny because if you had gone the traditional publishing route, you'd be nowhere close to making $5 a book, which is interesting.
Well, with traditional publishers, they've still got one major asset, and that's the ability to push a book. They can go through the hassle of submitting publishing to, they can go through the hassle of giving review copies to 500 reviewing places, Publishers Weekly. They can call Barnes & Noble directly and say, hi, we've got a book. This is when it's coming out. This is the format, and here are all the promotional materials. Deal with it, as opposed to publishing yourself, where you either find a marketer or you spend a lot of time on the phone calling individual bookstores. And not Barnes & Noble, because with CreateSpace, they take the attitude of, oh, you're going through an Amazon affiliate, are you? Yes, we're Barnes & Noble. We're not going to play with them or you. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Yeah. Well, but on the flip side of that, Declan, too, let me just put it out here. I've interviewed both traditionally published authors and self-published authors, and some of them who have done both, and they've all told me that either way, number one, you as the author are still responsible for a large portion of the marketing. And then the second thing, with the advent of social media, a very low-cost way of marketing yourself, I do think that you don't necessarily, now I'm not downplaying having a display at Barnes & Noble or wherever. I'm simply saying that you also have another whole area that's unlimited where you can reach out to your audience, connect with them, and engage them, and sell books by using social media platforms.
Oh, definitely.
What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Even one of my favorite authors, James Rollins, who I didn't quite model myself or my writing style on his work, but I really would like to be him when I grow up. But even James Rollins is using Facebook and social media to reach out and touch his fans repeatedly. That sounded better in my head, granted, but you know what I mean.
Yes, I did. Absolutely. And, you know, I interviewed another author, Mariam Cobras, a couple of weeks ago, and she had a great suggestion with the platform Pinterest, where she, and, you know, that's all, that whole, that platform runs on images, mm-hmm. and she created storyboards for each of her books using, you know, just finding images on the web that corresponded to either a character or a scene or a place in her novel, and actually created storyboards, and she said she was very successful with that in piquing people's interest, because, you know, the flip side of social media, and I want to, and I'll have you comment on this, is that I think that you can go crazy if you try to be on every platform. I think we need to kind of pick and choose two or three, maybe four tops that you're really going to work on a daily basis. And so I think with Pinterest now, we have the ability to create storyboards. And I know a lot of people are visual, and I think that I really thought that that was an interesting point and very innovative on her part to use that particular platform. Now you, on the other hand, one thing I want to commend you on is your ability to create these awesome videos at your blog. So talk a little bit about the platforms that you use, and then tell us about your videos and your book trailer, because I think you're excellent at utilizing that aspect of new technology.
Okay. Well, with my blog, it's, good Lord, I've been actually at it for about 4 years now, but at first, it was just a matter of, okay, this is my blog about writing. I hope to drum up some kind of interest for my novel, if and when it actually ever gets published. And after a while, it became this massive, unwieldy thing, but where pretty much anybody could talk about anything, a lot of religion, a lot of philosophy, politics, when I had a gun to my head. And that usually happened around election times, and whenever somebody opened their mouth and said something stupid, so basically once a month. And when you say videos, I've got the trailers and I've got the vlogs. The vlogs are far more recent, and I figured, hey, if I can actually string together a sentence, pretty much anybody can do this. I've discovered that, no, not anybody can do this, but I'm getting practice in. With the trailers, those were actually some of the first things I ever wanted to do, because I listen to music a lot while I'm writing, and these put images into my head as I go along, depending on the tune. So I stick in a good 2-3 minute piece of music, and images come to my head immediately, one right after the other. With A Pious Man, the first trailers were so very simple because it was at the height of the Da Vinci Code. So if I just take a little bit of the Mona Lisa's eyes and put them on an image, people will actually know where that was stolen from. Sorry, borrowed. And you could do those things one right after the other. And
so now, Declan, you yourself create your own trailers. You don't hire somebody to do that for you. You've kind of mastered that piece of technology.
Oh, yes. And most of what I've been using has been PhotoFilter. It's freeware. Anyone can download it. And all I do is I slightly modify some images, and congratulations, I'm done. I think the most work-intensive image I ever had to create was either an armored SUV going down the Spanish Steps, and if your audience is wondering what the heck does that mean, they'll have to read the book.
Yes, they will.
Yeah, and the other one was, okay, how do I create a chalk outline and put crime scene tape around it? Answer,
yeah.
Very, very long time.
Now, do you Do you offer your services professionally as someone who creates book trailers? Let's just say we have authors out there listening who say, yeah, I'd love a book trailer, but I can't be bothered creating it myself. Do you offer that service to other authors? Just out of curiosity.
I do now.
All right. See, maybe I got you some business.
We'll work for free PR.
But it's a serious point because a lot of people they see the value of a book trailer, but maybe they just don't feel like spending hours. You know, we all have different degrees of technology talent, I'll put it, and we have differing degrees of interest in learning how to do it. And I know there are a lot of people out there who would just rather pay somebody else to create a first class trailer for them than spend hours and hours trying to put one together themselves.
True enough.
So that's good to know. And your blog is, just so that everyone listening knows, you can find Declan's blog. It's apiousman.blogspot.com. And Declan, I know when we spoke on the Twitter chat last week, you mentioned that you were pretty happy with the blogger blogging platform. So for anyone listening, there are several out there that you can choose from. But the one thing we did talk about, and I want you to talk about it now, is the importance of having a blog and maintaining one as a writer. So tell us a little bit about, tell us your thoughts on that.
Well, it's definitely a great way to communicate with your audience, mostly. The amount of people who go through blogs seem to be endless. And it's easy to get... I say easy to get an audience, but it's easy if you're compulsive like me, who I have to write at least one blog a week, if not three. And at one point, I discovered this nice little thing called StumbleUpon.com. And like, okay, fine, I'll just load up every blog I've ever written. At that point, it was about 100 blogs, and suddenly I had 10,000 people coming to my website, and thankfully I didn't crash the darn thing. But it's a way to generate an audience, it's a way to keep in touch with them, and the amount of people I've had tripping over my blogs because of random images they were looking for, and trust me, I've had some very strange search terms popping up in where your traffic comes from in Blogger, because Blogger gives you stats. I presume most blog formats do. And some of the little keywords and search terms people have been looking for and came to my site are very strange. And, for example, I did a blog about why I think sex scenes in novels are a complete and utter waste of time. And if you're going to do it, you better make sure that has something to do with the plot. However, it was the same month I put up a music video from someone on YouTube called Lindsay Sterling. She's a violinist. She does some nice stuff and interesting dance moves while she's playing the violin. I wound up having people come to my site looking for... please cover your ears for anyone under the age of 15. They had people coming to my site looking for sex tapes starring her because my blog on sex scenes and my music blog with her were back to back.
Oh, that is so funny.
Yeah.
I'm sure she really appreciated that if she found out about it.
Well,
too funny.
Yeah, well, I won't tell her if you don't.
Okay. Your secret's safe with me, Declan.
Thanks.
Too funny. But, I think it's amazing to me that I run into a lot of writers and authors who just really don't want to maintain a blog. And I find that very perplexing to me because aside from everything you just mentioned and a way to connect and generate traffic and interest in your work, I think it also keeps your writing abilities sharp.
Oh, heck yes. Especially when you consider how many little pieces of marketing you can make with short stories. Daria, since you read the book, you know this, but in scattered throughout A Pious Man, which, for the record, is APIUS, not PIOUS, scattered throughout A Pious Man, there are little codes where you go to the blog, you type in the code, you get a short story. A lot of those I originally wrote because I was thinking, hey, marketing. And if that doesn't keep you sharp, nothing will. And not to mention, it helps when you're doing individual stories about your characters. Oh, look, well, I can't spoil anything for the book, so I'm going to have to do this as basically a few years before the story happens. And it's amazing how much background comes up and how fleshed out your characters can become, even with, you know, a neurotic like me who has to create a three-page biography for every character I use. They can still surprise me like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you hit upon such an excellent point. And I love that. I love that you do that. That's amazing. But I wanted to say that a lot of you've really mastered the marketing side of things. And I think that that's a piece, unfortunately, that's missing with a lot of authors. They're very resistant to that. And just as an example, and I'll ask you for your opinion, but you know, aside from being able to blog and interact on social media and really connect with your audience, I think that it's important to be able to verbally articulate about your writing and your book and your characters the way we are right now. And I have to tell you, I had an experience a couple of years ago interviewing an author who had written several books, a very talented woman, could not string more than like one sentence answers when I had her on the air. And it was like one of the longest interviews of my entire life. So, I mean, what do you think about that? And the second part of the question is, do you also market kind of locally where maybe you're going out and speaking to different groups in your area?
Well, to go backwards, I've been reaching out to church groups. I've been reaching out to the few local bookstores there are, you know, the ones that haven't been swallowed up by Barnes & Noble. Yes, I've been trying to press a lot of flesh, and I've still got a few hundred business cards to give out. You know, I'd be happy to mail them to you. But as far as the sociability of writers, let's face it, there are very few writers who go into this sort of thing if they were sociable. Myself, I can talk to you. I can ignore the rest of the universe. I can pretend nobody's listening aside from just you and me. And this works for me. I work well one-on-one. You put me before an audience, all I could think is, I'm going to read now, and I'm going to pretend none of you are here before I have a panic attack.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of writers who are like that. It's if they were sociable, would they be writers? We have a nice little profession that we make our own hours. We don't have to interact with too many people unless it's book-related. Unfortunately, that becomes a major handicap, and it's something I've struggled with, but one of the nice things with my training is, as a graduate student, as a PhD candidate, I did a lot of time speaking in front of groups, and I could usually fake it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it helps when I have a PowerPoint presentation that starts with, oh, fortuna.
Well, no, but and I'm glad to see that you're able to overcome that, because I just found from my own experience, and actually it's funny, I used Lulu 5 years ago. I'm probably going to use a different one for my sequel, but I found in my experience of marketing my book that people were just as interested in me, the author, and writing process and all of that as they were in the actual book and the story. And, you know, in my case, and kind of like, you know, kind of speaking to your story a little bit, you know, it was a boss that I had when I was in corporate marketing that finally just said to me, you know, you're doing such a great job. This is during a review. She goes, why are you nervous when you're giving presentations? You have information that these bank managers need. And I don't know why that finally clicked with me, but I got over it from that point on, because I used to be one of those white knuckle people too, standing at the podium. I hated that. But I think you kind of have to now, because people are interested in you as the author.
Oh, yes, especially since we're now living in a world where it's quote-unquote reality television, how much reality is up to you, where entertainment is now people. Oh, look, we can look at, oh, what the heck was, very strange family, the Osborne family, made into a reality show. where people are entertainment now. So, which
helps
with the marketing a lot, especially since, hey, look, social media.
Yeah, and I think you just have to be, but as a writer, you have to be very focused about it,
mm-hmm.
And targeted in knowing your audience. And really having the ability to interact, whether it's on social media or in real life, the ability to, like, start a conversation and then interact with people, whether it's a comment thread on Facebook or like we did with the Twitter chat, I think all of those things add up, and they do. They'll drive traffic to your site. They'll generate interest in your book, and hopefully then, you know, in turn lead to book sales.
Oh, yes. Well, then there's the flip side of social media, where I believe you mentioned it during your previous interview, the last hour, where you, and actually you mentioned it earlier this hour, with you start mentioning things like, oh, look, here is this, the Pope was not a Nazi, or here's a conversation about politics. In the vocabulary of the internet, welcome to your very own flame war.
Yeah.
Where you've got people who seem to, quote-unquote, troll because they enjoy causing a fight. Heck, I had that experience on my own blog a few years ago, and I was just talking about Lent and Easter. It's, okay, fine, we're going to give up stuff for Lent. I mean, good Lord, literally. Jesus Christ got nailed to a set of 2x4s in one of the most top 10 painful ways to die in recorded history. And we can give up candy for 40 days. Big deal. We can give up fish on Fridays. And I had made a comment about this atheist doing his own blog, and he was one of those Richard Dawkins fans, where he equated giving up stuff for Lent to child abuse. And all I could think was, wow.
What?
Yeah, it was completely ridiculous and utterly insane. And I made this comment of, yeah, I've got problems with what he said, and these are my problems, and I moved on. The guy heard about it and came to my blog, leaving 20 different comments, and he actually didn't address me at all. He went round and round with a friend of mine who was vivisecting his arguments. Which is quite entertaining, because my friend, Jason Bieber, who is a university professor, he's not even Catholic. He's Jewish. But he took this guy apart. But it's amazing what small, innocuous comments can lead into an entire shooting war online.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And, yeah, listen, I know that from my own experience as a political activist and certainly as the host of CRF Radio on Saturday nights with Steve Rosenblum. I mean, we've had situations in the chat room where, you know, there's sort of a fine line, and I'm all for free speech and debate, absolutely. But then when people start getting abusive with their language, that crosses the line. And so, you know, in the case of Blog Talk Radio, there's an ability to boot somebody out of the chat room if they're really offending other people or just being completely obnoxious and making their points.
Amen.
So, yeah, so there's definitely – and that's an excellent point. But I do think overall, though, that it's good to have these kinds of discussions, because I think the old adage about never discussing religion or politics has done a lot of harm to our country and certainly our culture and our society as a whole. So,
No question.
You know, so it's just it's a matter of – knowing when that line has been crossed and trying to keep people sort of within the bounds of, I guess, decent conversation while expressing opposing viewpoints. And it's hard. That's a hard dance to have sometimes.
Oh, yes. Well, the hard dance is when – where do you draw the line between, okay, he's just being a schmuck, he, she, or it is being annoying, and when it's, okay, it's time for you to go.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, and I look at it, if you have an argument based in fact and you want to debate on the facts, that's one thing. And after you've gone around and you've fully discussed it, if they're still now, you know, then they're just trolling and they're just, you know, using bad language or just being obnoxious, then for me that's when it's time for them to go.
Amen.
You know, so, but anyway, okay, so Declan, my gosh, we're down to the last couple of minutes. So, again, let everybody know where they can purchase your book, where we can find your blog, and anything else that maybe we haven't discussed that you'd like to get across here in the last couple of minutes.
Okay, well, you can find the book on Amazon.com, isn't everything, Kindle. That all my books are on Kindle right now, including the science fiction one, Codename Winterborn. It's actually free this week on Kindle, so everybody have a free book.
Awesome.
Let me see. The blog is apiusman.blogspot.com. If you type it in the correct way, don't worry, I've got a mirror site for that. It's slowly updating. And that's pretty much about it. I hope everyone buys the book, enjoys the book, loves the book. Please tell annoy everyone you know about the book.
Yeah, definitely buy the book. Read my review at my blog, DariaDiGiovanni.com. I'm telling you, I couldn't stop reading it. It's phenomenal. Just purely from an entertainment standpoint, you'll love the book. And also, Declan, you forgot to mention that you are on Twitter. So if there's any tweets out there, he's at
A
Pious Man Novel, and that's P-I-U-S-M-A-N. Mm-hmm. You can find him there. You can follow him and get him tweeting more. He needs to tweet more.
Well, I tweet. I've got the Facebook page. I've got two or three now. But A Pious Man, A Novel, is also out there. You will not find Declan Finn page yet. Give me time. I'm trying to do 15 things at once. Good Lord. I think I also have a Pinterest account, but it's been so long, I'm not even sure it's there. Oh, yes. And I've also got a budding column over at examiner.com. Just look for Del Can Finn, because examiner.com can't spell.
Okay.
But I have not yet found a way to do a review of my own book on examiner.com. When I do, I'm sure it'll be up and running in 5 minutes. And Daria, I would like to thank you. I read your review. I enjoyed it immensely. I especially liked how on Sunday evening I got an email from you on, you're only on chapter two, but you love the book. I saw the next Monday morning it was, sorry I'm late, I was up late reading the book. And
that's right.
By Monday evening it's, I finished the book. I think you were more excited about it than I was.
Oh, it was so good. And it drew me in. And that's music to every author's ears. Don't you like hearing that? I couldn't put your book down. Put it down. In this case, it was I couldn't stop scrolling because I was reading it on my computer screen. But, nevertheless, it was still a phenomenal book, and I really enjoyed it. And certainly from my perspective as a fellow Catholic and somebody who's kind of fed up with all these conspiracy theories, on another level, I really appreciated that your fictional book also clears up a lot of these falsehoods. So I really appreciated that. But even if you're not Catholic, I guess my point is the book is a thriller. It really is. And you just don't know what's going to happen next. And you have all these cool characters, and it's just great. The pacing's perfect. And so get out there and buy Declan's book. Those are my final words today for Write Stream Tuesday. So Declan, thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm sure I'll be seeing you on Facebook and on Twitter. And also, folks, he does book trailers. So if you need a book trailer, contact him.
Yep, you can get me through Facebook. You can get me through the blog. I'm easy.
Excellent. All right, Declan. Well, God bless, and I'll see you out there on social media. Take
God
care.
God bless, Daria. You too. Bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up another Write Stream Tuesday. I hope you enjoyed it. To those of you who will be listening in the archive, thank you for your support. Please check out all of the archives at blogtalkradio.com/WriteStream. And until next week, keep rejoicing in the flow of creativity.